The doctrine of discovery was the embodiment of the European ruling class's insatiable desire for expansion and control over the New World. These powers, backed by papal authority, deployed the notion of terra nullis, meaning nobody's land, which was used to justify their claims over indigenous territories across Turtle Island. This era of so-called discovery was first set in motion with Christopher Columbus landing on what is today known as the Americas in 1492. 4 years later, this period of discovery was further highlighted by John Cabot's arrival on the shores of what we now call Newfoundland on June 24, 1497. In the following century, French explorer Jacques Cartier took three journeys to the New World, funded by King Francis I of France. These 16th century expeditions marked the peak of the Age of Discovery, spanning from 1534 to 1541. On July 24, 1534, Cartier landed on the Goss Peninsula, claiming the territory for France under the authority of the Doctrine of Discovery, though it was already inhabited by the Mohawk and Mi'kmaq indigenous peoples. 2 years later, Cartier journeyed up what became known as the St. Lawrence River to an indigenous village in today's Quebec in 1536, and on his final expedition in 1541, Cartier explored the St. Lawrence up to the mouth of the Great Lakes, opening up the New World to further European exploration and settlement. The journey to Turtle Island for these so-called explorers was intertwined at the concurrent birth of the discovery doctrine, and both are historical events that profoundly reshaped the trajectory of human history. The inception of the discovery doctrine is attributed to a series of papal bulls, including Romanus Pontifex and Intercitera. These religious edicts empowered European Christian monarchs with the authority to discover, claim, and convert all non-Christian indigenous peoples and their territories. Later, the doctrine's judicial legitimacy was further affirmed by the landmark 1823 U.S. Supreme Court case Johnson v. McIntosh, which upheld the exclusive right of European nations to acquire American lands from its indigenous inhabitants. Upon codification into the U.S. Constitution and Canadian Confederation, the doctrine of discovery was used to facilitate state-sanctioned land theft, child slavery, and genocidal attempts at ethnic cleansing against the indigenous population of Turtle Island. The doctrine of discovery set in motion a relentless wave of colonization and exploitation of indigenous peoples of the so-called New World. For this reason, in recent years, there have been escalating calls to reassess and discard the doctrine due to its detrimental effects on indigenous rights and sovereignty.
The Catholic Church has officially repudiated the concepts and the doctrine of discovery that said any land not inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered and indigenous peoples could be overthrown. Today, some are saying the church still hasn't gone far enough.
On March 30th, 2023, the Catholic Church issued a statement distancing itself from the contentious doctrine of discovery. The Church declared that the doctrine does not reflect the teachings of the Catholic faith and that the historical papal documents used to justify it do not accurately represent the Church's beliefs. The Church officially repudiated any concept that fails to acknowledge rights of indigenous peoples, stating that they, quote, seek to foster reconciliation and healing.
The CBC's Sarah Levitt is standing by in Montreal. She's covering the story for us. Sarah.
So, Arthi, this statement from the Vatican is essentially an apology for the doctrine of discovery. And, you know, that's the as you said, the Catholic Church theory that dates back to the 1400s, that essentially legitimized the seizure of indigenous land. It kind of gave the green light for colonization. Now the Vatican is saying this doctrine, I'll just quote, did not adequately reflect the equal dignity and rights of indigenous peoples. Now, we know that rejecting the doctrine was one of the demands that the Canadian indigenous peoples had when Pope Francis visited Canada last year. It's complicated language, of course. Everything is very careful when it comes to the Catholic Church. And so it is being repudiated, not rescinded. So it's essentially apologizing, but not fully rejecting the papal bulls that involve this.
The Catholic Church's actions have instigated a reevaluation of the significant role that the Vatican has played in shaping the colonial policies of countries like Canada. In very simple terms, at the very beginning of this historical period known as the Age of Discovery, the Vatican stood alone as a religious institution that could wield the state power and authority of divine right, which was used as an ideological foundation for colonial expansion, which contributed directly to the dispossession and subjugation of indigenous populations in the name of civility and Christendom.
Exactly on that question of whether it's rescinded or repudiated, if you recall, when the Pope visited the church near Quebec City, there were two women that stood up during the service and held a flag that said rescind the doctrine. So some not very happy that the church is using repudiated rather than rescinded. But a note that it does appear that this meets the call to Action 49 from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I'll just read from that to you. We call upon all religious denominations and faith groups who have not already done so to repudiate concepts used to justify European sovereignty over indigenous lands and peoples, such as the doctrine of discovery. And, you know, these papal bulls, they basically formed the basis of many property laws around the world that still exist today. So the question is, what happens now? Here's the chief commissioner from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women.
What the point is now is all of us, all Canadians, have to go back to the drawing board, so to speak, and say, okay, just then what was the basis and what remains the basis for Canada as a country or as a nation having the underlying title to all of the land here.
And Arthi, you know, I mentioned this is complex. There's the use of complicated language here and exactly what the Vatican is saying in its statement. But this also does affect Indigenous people around the world. Let's hear from a Shawnee scholar and an expert on the doctrine.
We're talking about very clear patterns of domination and empire that have been used against our nations and peoples and continue to be used against our nations and peoples to this day. And that is the kind of specific language that the Vatican is not quoting and not copying to. They're not coming clean with that horrible historical record.
So the question here now is this a first step forward? What happens now? And is this statement going to lead to anything, or is it truly just symbolic?
In response to the Catholic Church's recent statement, a thorough examination of Canada's past and present is required to understand the complex relationship that the Vatican's religious influence had on colonization and how it is connected directly to the ongoing struggles of Indigenous peoples here on Turtle Island today. As we examine the conquest of Turtle Island and the infamous doctrine of discovery that facilitated it, we must do so while remaining committed to promoting restitution, healing, and justice for all Indigenous peoples and the protection of their territories. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that this podcast has been recorded on unceded Indigenous territory. Xinjiang, otherwise known as Montreal, is celebrated historically as a convergence point for several Indigenous nations, including the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe people. Today, this area remains inhabited by a diverse mix of Indigenous communities and Canadian settlers from a variety of ethnic backgrounds. The history of these lands that we now call Canada provides context to our collective existence. It offers solace and understanding in its reflection and gives space not to place blame, but to better understand ourselves and how we historically have treated each other and the natural world around us. Those of us privileged enough to live on Turtle Island today must never forget the struggles faced by the indigenous peoples who have inhabited these lands long before the colonial creation of Canada ever existed. As settlers, it is our duty to reconcile with the realities of this colonial past and to assist in the struggle for true restitution, restoration of indigenous land title, self-determination, and sovereignty. In these efforts, it is hoped that we can acknowledge the profound impacts that these historical atrocities have had on the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island and the intrinsic connection that was once held between the inhabitants of these lands and the land itself. Throughout this series, we aim to cohesively portray the chilling legacy of the Doctrine of Discovery and the catastrophic effects that it had on the indigenous civilizations of Turtle Island. This is a sobering reminder of the veiled colonial underpinning that makes up the identity of so-called Canada, hidden beneath our feet in these vast picturesque landscapes and multicultural cities. Like any introspective journey, we will begin with an acknowledgement of the past, recognizing the systemic oppression practice and a historical erasure implemented to cover up the genocidal acts of these colonial institutions. As European powers sought to expand their influence, they engaged in practices that disrupted traditional ways of life, undermined indigenous sovereignty, and threatened the survival of entire indigenous civilizations. The territorial acquisition of so-called Canada was achieved through a complex and tumultuous history marked by the displacement of many indigenous communities. This was the result of jingo imperialism, fraudulent treaties, and brutal, oftentimes even deadly, colonial enforcement by both the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and armed forces. As a colonial state, Canada's reliance on resource extraction has perpetuated ongoing colonization and exploitation of the land it was founded on. The vast natural resources of the land known as Turtle Island have played a significant role in the development of Canada as a colonial state. With abundant deposits of oil, gas, and minerals such as zinc, nickel, and gold, the country of so-called Canada has become one of the world's largest suppliers of precious metals and fossil fuels. Exploiting these resources from the land has come with an unimaginable cost for many indigenous peoples here on Turtle Island who have been systemically displaced, dispossessed, and historically oppressed by these colonial resource extraction projects, their policies, and environmental practices. The mining industry has been a significant part of Canada's economy for over a century, specifically in northern regions where agriculture is unviable. Many towns in these areas have been sustained only by nearby mines, often at the expense of the environment and the well-being of indigenous communities. As covered in our last episode, the Canadian prairies, which have become one of the world's most important producers of wheat and canola, have a history of land dispossession and displacement of indigenous peoples, with acts of resistance from land defenders such as Louis Riel ending colonial violence with fatal state-sanctioned consequences. In the course of European colonization on Turtle Island, an unexpected deluge of diseases wreaked havoc on the indigenous inhabitants, causing widespread devastation unlike anything seen before. When European settlers arrived, they carried with them an array of unfamiliar diseases that proved devastating for scores of indigenous communities. Most indigenous peoples prior to European contact had no natural immunity to foreign pathogens, making them extraordinarily vulnerable to the unprecedented health threats introduced by these settlers. Illnesses such as smallpox, influenza, measles, and chickenpox spread swiftly through most of Turtle Island. Indigenous communities connected through travel and trade routes along waterways, unknowingly expedited the transmission of these pathogens, spreading death and disease rapidly across the entire continent. Modern historical narratives tend to shift the responsibility of this mass eradication caused by the onslaught of foreign microbes by suggesting this was simply an unintentional outcome of human progression and migration. This perspective, however, conveniently dodges the ethical responsibility presented when faced with the consequences of what colonialism colonial mythology portrays as the natural evolution of history. Nonetheless, the significant role that colonization played in this dramatic dissemination of disease is often downplayed or even removed from the conventional historical discourse. Yet, it's undeniable that colonization played a key role in introducing fatal infections to the indigenous populations of Turtle Island. In fact, historical accounts confirm that during colonization, diseases were occasionally weaponized for the purpose of imperial motivations and colonial subjugation. One notorious case of this that is often cited occurred at the 1763 siege of Fort Pitt during the French and Indian War. It is here where British officers have been alleged to have distributed smallpox-infected blankets to indigenous delegates, hoping to infect their communities. Around a century later, a smallpox outbreak among the indigenous peoples of the Shakotan region of colonial British Columbia further illustrates the willingness of colonizers to deploy disease as a means of biological warfare. At the time of the 1862 epidemic, indigenous communities in the Pacific Northwest had not yet encountered a smallpox epidemic and thus were left vulnerable due to a lack of immunity. Consequently, the disease spread rapidly throughout the Shakotan region, causing death on a mass scale, with roughly 70% of the Shakotan population being wiped out by the end of the first wave of the epidemic. This devastating spread of disease among the indigenous peoples of the Northwest was viewed by the British Columbian colonial state as a chance to dispossess a weakened indigenous population from their lands. In fact, following the initial wave of the epidemic, the colony of British Columbia's Chief Commissioner of Land and Works, Joseph Trutch, disregarded indigenous land rights and terminated the treaty process entirely. This act essentially established the precedent for British Columbia to be a viable state for the future Canadian Confederation, which was made possible by the seizing of indigenous lands without treaty or succession. In the spring of 1864, the Shakotan, like many other indigenous First Nations of the Pacific Northwest, were still recovering from the first wave of the smallpox epidemic a few years prior. It was then when they learned of the plans for a wagon road to go through the Homathko River Valley later that year. The Shakotan resisted the threat of this territorial violation with an armed blockade, which led to the Shakotan War of 1864. Prior to this conflict, many indigenous groups, including the Shakotan, were convinced that the epidemic was intentionally propagated by British colonizers for the purpose of driving them off their lands, a claim that has now become supported by official government documents. Historical evidence shows that during the conflict leading up to the Shakotan War and before the 1864 smallpox outbreak, Alfred Waddington, the man behind the wagon road project, or potentially one of his foremen, threatened the Shakotan peoples with the intent to spread the smallpox infection further. In the end, as some predicted, the conflict culminated with the resurgence of the smallpox epidemic in the Shakotan region, along with the death of six Shakotan chiefs who were executed by hanging for their roles in the wagon road blockade. Waddington's road was never fully finished due to the war, but was later considered as a potential route for the Canadian Pacific Railway, which was instead led to present-day Vancouver. The devastation left behind by the second wave of this epidemic resulted in the consolidation of numerous deserted indigenous villages by the colonial state of British Columbia. It also resulted in further cultural erasure and a heightened tension between indigenous peoples and colonial British Columbia that has gone on in this region since before Canada was a country, up until the current present day. In 2014, British Columbia Premier Christy Clark formally absolved the six executed Shawkatin chiefs and expressed regret for their deaths. Clark admitted in her apology in the government record that there was, quote, an indication that smallpox had been spread intentionally. In 2018, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau further acknowledged this historic injustice, making an in-person apology to the Shawkatin community.
Hello, everyone. It is an honor to be welcomed here as Prime Minister of Canada on the title land of the Tsilhqot'in Nation. Last spring, I stood in the House of Commons to recognize the actions past governments committed against your people and to express the Government of Canada's profound regret for this injustice. But it was also essential to deliver this important message here, before you, on your land. It is my privilege to be here today to honor the courage and sacrifice shown by the Tsilhqot'in chiefs 154 years ago. Warrior chiefs who were treated and tried as criminals in an era where both the colonial government and the legal process did not respect the inherent rights of the Tsilhqot'in people and the Tsilhqot'in nation. Long before the arrival of Europeans, the Tsilhqot'in people cared for and protected these homelands. In the spring of 1864, the Tsilhqot'in chiefs led a war party in defense of those homelands. The chiefs were attempting to repel a colonial road crew that wanted to build a road through Tsilhqot'in territory without any legal agreement with the Tsilhqot'in nation. As settlers came to the land in the rush for gold, no consideration was given to the needs of the Tsilhqot'in people who were there first. No agreement was made to access this land, no consent was sought, and so the Tsilhqot'in people took action to defend their territory. After convening a council to declare war, they attacked the road crew near Butte Inlet and removed all settlers from their lands before taking refuge in their territory beyond the reach of the colonial militia. Not long after, one of the leaders of the colonial militia sent the Tsilhqot'in chiefs a sacred gift of tobacco and, with it, an invitation to discuss terms of peace. Head War Chief Tlatosin and his men accepted this truce. As a show of goodwill, they rode into the camp to negotiate peace. Instead of being welcomed as leaders and respected warriors, they were arrested, imprisoned, convicted, and killed. On October 26, 1864, five Tsilhqot'in chiefs were hanged for murder. Head War Chief Tlatosin, Chief Biyil, Chief Telad, Chief Takut, and Chief Chesus. They are buried in Quesnel, BC. Later, Chief Ahan was also hanged and is buried in New Westminster. Last spring, our government acknowledged what the colonial government of the day was unwilling to accept, that these six chiefs were leaders and warriors of the Tsilhqot'in nation, and that the Tsilhqot'in people they led maintained rights to this land that had never been ceded. As an important symbol of our commitment to reconciliation, we confirm without reservation that these six Tsilhqot'in chiefs are fully exonerated of any crime or wrongdoing.
Good evening. Thank you for tuning in to Face to Face. Our guest this week is policy analyst and former candidate for the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Russ Dybo. Russ is a member of the Mohawk Nation of Ganawage. He's been active in Indigenous politics since he was a teenager and was at the Wounded Knee standoff in 1973. He's worked for the National Indian Brotherhood and the Assembly of First Nations. Russ also worked on the Liberal Party's Aboriginal platform in the 1993 election. And he's also been dead set against Justin Trudeau Liberal government's planned recognition and implementation of Indigenous rights framework. And Russ, that's where I'd like to start with. What type of consequences were you speaking of?
Well, I was speaking of the consequences that our people were getting fed up, you know, across the country. The colonial system, is making our conditions worse. Our children are being apprehended by child welfare agencies in record numbers. You know, it's basically continuing the cycle of moving them from the families and communities into, you know, the juvenile system and into prisons. Mm-hmm. And so the social problems that we're seeing across the country, the problems we're seeing with the Tina Fontaine and Colton Bushy, you know, the problems with the justice system are all problems with the structure of Canada, of colonialism and racism.
Canada is founded on two racist property concepts. One is a doctrine of discovery, and the other one is terra nullius. That was one of the first recommendations of the $55 million Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples that was commissioned by Brian Mulroney. That was one of the first recommendations, was to get rid of those doctrines in use in negotiations by governments and also the use of the governments in courts as justification for continued theft of lands and resources from First Nations. So with that being the origins of Canada and how its territorial claims started, they never advanced that view towards the First Nations when they made contact. With the Haudenosaunee, the beginning of the treaty-making process in North America really started, you know, with Europeans, and first with the Dutch and then later with the British. And that treaty relationship evolved into what we call the covenant chain relationship later on, you know, between the British and the Haudenosaunee. But in 1760, the British wanted the alliance of the Indigenous nations when they were moving on Montreal to conquer the French. And because the Indigenous nations controlled the waterways, they asked for them to be neutral. So there was a treaty at Oswegatchie that was made in 1760 of, you know, peace and friendship. And when they conquered Montreal, there was another treaty at Ganawage in 1760. And the nations that were represented there were basically sometimes it's called the Seven Nations Confederacy, sometimes the Nine Nations, depending on how you count. But it was basically the Christianized Indians around the former French allies who became allies with the British. And that, you know, led to the Royal Proclamation of 1763, where promises were made not to allow settlers to trespass on Indian lands, and that led to, I think, one of the most significant treaties in Canada, which is the Niagara Treaty of 1764, because that brought thousands and thousands of First Nations representatives to Niagara Falls to enter into a treaty with the British, and it brought the Haudenosaunee together with the Anishinaabe Nations. And that's what I find significant, is that was under the covenant chain relationship. Now, that was respected, until after, you know, the War of 1812, when Indians started to be outnumbered by settlers and weren't as big a military threat as they were previously, which is why those treaties were made, you know, to keep peace. And that's when you start to see the relationship shift to one of trying to assimilate Indians and, end their rights despite the promises that were made, you know.
They're taking the land, which which is rightfully ours. Years from now, my people will be forced to live in mobile homes on reservations. Your people will wear cardigans and drink highballs. We will sell our bracelets by the roadsides. You will play golf and enjoy hot hors d'oeuvres. My people will have pain and degradation. Your people will have stick shifts. The gods of my tribe have spoken. They have said, do not trust the pilgrims. And for all these reasons, I've decided to scalp you and burn your village to the ground.
The Doctrine of Discovery's influence on the European Crown's colonial occupation of Turtle Island continues to echo in present-day circumstances, most notably reflected in many Indigenous households across First Nations communities in all of so-called Canada. Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island living in present-day Canada represent approximately 5% of the population, but face substantially higher rates of poverty, incarceration, and physical and mental health issues compared to their non-Indigenous settler counterparts. This disparity underscores many of the systemic hardships faced by Indigenous peoples living today in so-called Canada, and how these hardships originate from the roots of this country's violent colonial past. It also exemplifies the truth about cultural genocide as an ever-present and ongoing atrocity, which is still very much taking place at the behest of the Canadian state. Yet, in the face of all this injustice, the Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island have never relinquished their territory, nor their spirit of resistance. Even today, Indigenous peoples living within the borders of so-called Canada demonstrate the same resilience that characterized their struggle with European colonizers during the Age of Discovery. As settlers on Turtle Island, we have a duty to accurately acknowledge and communicate that this grim historical period of colonial domination and occupation has never really ended. It is also essential for us to proactively prevent further colonial myths from presenting themselves in the face of increased historical denial and revisionism. These ongoing acts of colonial violence, displacement, cultural erasure, and holistic genocide are not merely historical subjects to be debated, but are to represent the continued reality that many Indigenous communities on Turtle Island grapple with each and every day. The main objective with this content is to build towards a profound understanding of the disastrous human catastrophe that accompanied the Europeans and their so-called discovery and colonization of the New World. We hope to contribute to what is an ongoing conversation surrounding the history of the Canadian state, born from the conquest of Turtle Island and raised to deny its colonial roots. In this episode, we will begin a journey that will take us into the shadows of our own history, unearthing complex roots that will point us towards a significant confrontation with our collective past and all of the genocidal colonial implications. As for the word Canada, it is said to originate from the St. Lawrence Mohawk word Canada, meaning village or settlement. But the story of the land that makes up present-day Canada goes back much further than the word itself. Long before Canada was even a glimmer in the European settler's eye, this land was home to many vibrant civilizations of Indigenous peoples, resilient communities that have been deeply woven into the fabric of this land for thousands upon thousands of years. And while it may not seem that way on the surface, the true essence of this land that makes up so-called Canada today is still very much rooted in the traditions, customs, and histories of the Indigenous peoples who have inhabited these lands long before European colonizers had ever arrived. This is where we will begin our examination of the Doctrine of Discovery's colonial impacts. First, by understanding what life was like for Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island in the era before the grips of European colonialism took hold.
The Government of Canada sincerely apologizes and asks the forgiveness of the Aboriginal peoples of this country for failing them so profoundly.
This is stolen land where you've been standing. Understand it, switch it from stitching bandage to substantive with derangement of some things. Reparation made for corporate gain. First Nation pain's a moral stain. We hide genocide on reservations. Too many pages of our history's erased to mitigate the national shame of it. Built by slave black labor, hobbling arrogant racist John A. McDonald. $10 notes is check the quotes. Genocide personified, exposed. Colonial Gulf Coast. And they got railway posts for the Chinese ghosts. Mine for diamond, nickel and gold. Total control of petrol flow. Ayo, no Canada.
We want none of that bogus, broken corporate management, jingle, patriot, fascist, petro-national, carbon capital, man. Do you understand where you stand? Global capital of resource extraction, fracking, mining, and conflict diamond. The gold, silver's the other mineral facts. We hide the villainous minds behind it. We hide the ties of culpability binding to ecocide they leave behind them. Our law facilitates the rape of the lands, the lakes, and the forests that we take from shore, offshore, Earth's core. Suck the source while cops enforce it. The true north is a fortress for the corporate. Out of war forfeit. For the profits, it's subsidized, colonized a force. Police report the mixed stock price soar. This is war like it was before. Mama Earth versus the company store. Ayo, no Canada, we want none of that. Bogus, broken corporate management, jingle, patriot, fascist, petro-national, carbon capital, man. Do you understand where you stand?
New research is rewriting the narrative about the history of Turtle Island and the indigenous peoples that first inhabited these lands. Modern scholars are beginning to challenge many deeply ingrained misconceptions that have unjustly branded the lives of these pre-colonial indigenous peoples as overly simplistic, unenlightened, or abandoned by the progress of civilization. However, evidence suggests that the pre-colonial indigenous societies on Turtle Island were highly sophisticated and socially advanced, thriving across the Western Hemisphere long before Europeans began to even etch images on cave walls. In fact, by the time Christopher Columbus embarked on his first voyage in 1492, the population of the Meso and southern regions of the so-called New World were believed to have exceeded that of the European Old World. The cultural richness among these pre-colonial indigenous societies also outpaced their European counterparts in many ways. This is a fact that is often overlooked due to a deeply entrenched cultural bias. This misrepresentation of indigenous history is not confined to Turtle Island. Western ethnocentrism has not only affected how we perceive geography, causing the distortion of Africa's actual size in world maps that use the Mercator projection, but it has also skewed the interpretation of indigenous history in the so-called New World. These distortions often lead to the marginalization of indigenous civilizations lesser known beyond the well-known documented Aztec or Inca empires. The common narrative tends to depict these early indigenous peoples of Turtle Island as passive inhabitants of a pristine wilderness. This viewpoint has even been echoed by prominent historians of the 20th century who once described these indigenous territories as empty space, wilderness, and virgin land. This contemptuous attitude towards the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island has seeped so deep into the societal consciousness that it is often accepted as truism, requires no proof of concept, and is merely passed down by anecdotal repetition from one generation to the next. This strategic devaluation of the demographic, cultural, and moral significance of the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island is part of a politically driven narrative often referred to as colonial mythology. Like the colonial myths that underpin South Africa's apartheid system, these narratives distort population estimates and exaggerate notions of indigenous barbarism to rationalize colonial conquest. These fabricated histories serve to justify the decimation of indigenous people's culture and alleviate any moral discomfort associated with colonization. This trend of colonial mythology is not exclusive to Turtle Island. It can also be seen in South Africa, Israel, Australia, New Zealand, in Central and South America, and in many other countries worldwide that have experienced colonial and post-colonial rule. These narratives follow imperialistic logic and begin by erasing indigenous histories and traditions. Once the indigenous peoples have been expunged from collective memory, the colonizers assert their moral and intellectual right to conquer lands for the purpose of what is often said to be human progress and civility. To maintain a self-congratulatory national narrative, partitioned indigenous territories are seldom recognized as sovereign or separate nations, but are included within the colonial state's borders and national identity. Meanwhile, demands to establish an honest narrative about the truth of these historical acts of land theft, dispossession, and ethnic genocide largely remain unanswered or ignored entirely. Thankfully, as mentioned, a growing number of mainstream scholars are now challenging these colonial narratives, working to correct the problematic portrayal of indigenous societies before European contact. However, some counter-arguments to this viewpoint, specifically from the idealist perspective that lacks proper historical context, runs the risk of presenting these societies through the lens of an unreasonable idolization. Hence, it's extremely important to maintain a balanced viewpoint that acknowledges both the intricate sophistications and mundane normalities of these indigenous societies, while also resisting the romanticizing of them as paradisical or utopian. With all of that said, what we know is that despite facing many natural material hardships, indigenous peoples of Turtle Island in the pre-colonial era led lives marked by a harmonious relationship with nature, a bond in which was reflected in their collective social behaviors and even state structures. The story of the first human habitation of Turtle Island is a complex narrative rife with contentious scholarly debates and speculations, which is shaped by an array of disciplines, including archaeology, genetics, anthropology, and paleoclimatology. The prevailing theory long proposed is that the initial human migration onto Turtle Island occurred via Beringia, a land bridge that connected what is now Alaska and eastern Siberia during the last glacial maximum about 26,000 to 19,000 years ago. It is thought that the harsh climatic conditions during this time period forced these early inhabitants to seek shelter in the protective regions of Beringia, an event often referred to as the Beringian standstill. The end of this time period was marked by a number of significant environmental changes. The retreat of colossal glaciers, synonymous with the end of the Wisconsin glaciation period, allowed these early inhabitants to move southward. As the climate warmed, glaciers receded and an ice-free corridor between the Laurentide and Kerdillerian ice sheets opened, and a route into the heart of Turtle Island became accessible. As time moved forward, these early inhabitants embarked on an even more extensive southward migration, leading to the habitation of nearly every corner of the continent, ranging from the Great Lakes to the southernmost tip of what is known today as South America. But this Beringian migration route is not the only hypothesis put forward. More recent scholars proposed an early coastal migration pathway where early migrants might have traveled south along the Pacific coastline, either by sea or through a narrow glaciated continent shelf exposed due to low sea levels. This theory is backed by archaeological evidence from other parts of the globe showing successful sea migration to places like New Guinea and Australia around 50,000 years ago. Key archaeological findings, such as the Monteverde site in Chile, with artifacts dating back over 13,000 years, ranging from wooden structures, animal bones, to grinding stones and processed plant remains, have given us clear evidence of early human habitation in this region, supporting the fact that sophisticated human societies on Turtle Island existed at least tens of thousands of years ago. Now, despite such compelling evidence, doubts and skepticism has remained, especially given the lack of early human presence in eastern Siberia and the absence of non-modern human skeletal remains on Turtle Island. However, these doubts have been scrutinized with the advent of more sophisticated dating techniques and archaeological discoveries that came in the late 20th century.
The skull and bones of Kennewick Man turned up on the banks of the Columbia River in eastern Washington more than a year ago. Now they're locked up in federal custody as American Indians, pagans, and scientists battle over their future.
In 1996, along the banks of the Columbia River in Washington State, a significant archaeological finding occurred. A remarkably well-preserved Paleo-American skeleton surfaced along the riverbank, estimated to be around 9,000 years old.
Anthropologist James Chatters often helps the district coroner when old bones are found. He determines whether they are the remains of a recent murder victim or of someone who has been buried for a very long time. The farthest thing from his mind was that this discovery would prompt a stormy debate on the origins of mankind in North America.
We had something extremely important, one of the very few complete skeletons anyone near that old in the Americas.
Now all James Chatters has is this plaster cast. He calls the bones a scientific treasure. Native Americans call them an ancestor.
It's a sacrilege when sacred human remains are removed from the ground.
Armin Minthorn's tribe is claiming Kennewick Man under a U.S. law that gives control of ancestral remains to modern-day tribes. The Umatillas object to any in-depth analysis of the skeleton.
We have oral histories that tell us how our ancestors lived 10,000 years ago, where they lived 10,000 years ago, and how they lived. We know that already. We didn't cross no land bridge like the scientists told us. We were created here. That's what our religion tells us.
Who was Kennewick Man, and how did he get here? Scientists say the bones may hold the answers, but they won't know them until they can hold the bones. Don Knapp, CNN, Kennewick, Washington.
The Kennewick Man's physical characteristics sparked theories of varied migration sources in prehistoric times, yet linking him genetically to the initial Beringian or Asian populations has been complex due to difficulties in categorizing ancient DNA. Although Siberia is often cited as an early migration source, concrete archaeological evidence is still lacking. Some speculate these ancient migrants preferred coastal climates, with traces of their journey possibly erased by subsequent marine activity. It's also possible that Beringia, extending far south during glacial peaks, may have harbored migrants from different regions, challenging the assumption of Siberia being the sole source of migration. In the northeast regions of Turtle Island, archaeological evidence of early human presence that is more than 42,000 years old is very limited. However, archaeology as a discipline has continually reinforced the understanding that a lack of evidence does not equate to evidence of absence. Site degradation and loss are common phenomena in severe environments, and there is always room for new discoveries. This is especially relevant considering the vast time discrepancy between evidence of modern humans in northeast regions of Turtle Island and elsewhere, possibly up to over 100,000 years. Even the belief that modern humans emerged around 42,000 to 52,000 years ago is now being debated, with new estimates indicating modern humans appeared significantly earlier, perhaps close to 200,000 years ago. Advancements in linguistics and genetics have contributed to understanding the timeline and roots of the initial human migration to Turtle Island. Evidence points to multiple major population movements over the last 50,000 years. The tremendous diversity of languages and cultures along the western coast of so-called Canada, especially near Vancouver, suggests that it may have been an early human dispersal route. Despite many disruptions, indigenous cultures of this region have persisted for over thousands of years, with over 100 tribes and First Nations dispersed across regions from BC to Idaho today.
If you do not believe the fact that our people were living in cities and built great civilizations, you can read American Holocaust by David Standard, a University of Hawaii professor of history, a person of European descent.
Before the arrival of Europeans in 1492, Turtle Island was known for its impressive mix of diverse languages. It is estimated that there were between 1,500 and 2,000 different languages, which came from more than 150 unique language families. In the years prior to European contact, no other place in the world had such wide range of language diversity. The roots of these languages have long been a subject of academic contention. Some scholars argue that these languages evolved from a single ancestral language spoken by an early migratory group to Turtle Island about 50,000 years ago. More recent studies, however, have countered this theory, showing that linguistic diversity is too advanced to have been derived from less than the known 150 language families. Historian David Stainard's influential book, American Holocaust, provides a deep dive into the geographical and linguistic diversity in Turtle Island during the last ice age, a period that stretched from approximately 14,000 to 1,000 years ago. This research underscores the vibrant cultural diversity that marked this era, hinting at numerous unique language groups scattered across various regions of the continent. One of the pivotal insights from Stainer's work is the likelihood that distinct populations resided in isolation for extended periods of time. This isolation could have fostered the development of unique languages and cultural practices, each mirroring the distinctive environmental conditions and resources of the region they inhabited. The timeline and population size of this expanse southward migration remain subjects of substantial academic discussion and interpretation. Understanding the migration patterns of these indigenous groups is key to unraveling the story of the early histories of Turtle Island. What we know now is that around 17,000 years ago, indigenous society had taken root across various regions of Turtle Island. These included areas like the Pacific Coast, the Northern Plains, and the Eastern Woodlands beyond the Rocky Mountains. Their survival strategies largely revolved around hunting and gathering a diverse array of fauna and plant species. These groups generally moved from north to south and from west to east, tracking the availability of resources. Interestingly, some groups traced a different trajectory, advancing northwards in the alignment with the retreat of the Ice Age glaciers. This evolution of migration pattern reflects the high capacity for adaptability in these early indigenous societies. Similar to the debate on migration, we see an even more contentious debate about the pre-colonial population levels of Turtle Island, which continues to attract considerable academic interest today. Recent research indicates that the pre-colonial population of Turtle Island could have ranged from 75 to 145 million people, a drastic departure from the initial estimated 8 million. This dramatic shift in population figures resulted from a re-evaluation of historical evidence, which presents a counter to many traditional colonial narratives. It uncovers a pre-European Turtle Island that was not only far more populous, but also imbued with a level of cultural diversity far exceeding previous assumptions. This new, revised perspective offers a deeper, more nuanced understanding of the history of these lands and the early indigenous peoples that inhabited them long before the era of colonization.
Columbus sailed the ocean in 1492 with the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria too. Oh, Columbus found America in 1492.
Having a discussion about Christopher Columbus.
They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them and make them do whatever we want. That doesn't sound like a slave trader to you?
George Washington had slaves, the father of our country.
Well, what's your point?
Look, you had to work in Columbus's shoes to see what he went through. People thought the world was flat, for crying out loud. Then he lands on an island with a bunch of naked savages on it. I mean, that took a lot of guts. You remember when we went to Florida, the heat, and those bugs?
Well, like it took guts to murder people and put them in chains.
He was a victim of his time.
Who cares? It's what he did.
He discovered America is what he did. He was a brave Italian explorer, and in this house, Christopher Columbus is a hero. End of story.
Current historical understandings recognize Christopher Columbus not as the inaugural discoverer of so-called America, but instead as one of many European colonizers to venture there during the Age of Discovery. This viewpoint aligns with German cartographer Martin Waldseemüller's 1507 world map, which labeled the newfound territory as America in honor of Italian explorer Amerigo Vespucci. Vespucci discerned that the landmass of Turtle Island was a distinct entity rather than an offshoot of the Asian continent. Ironically, this recognition of a separate landmass is a discovery that is often misattributed to Columbus rather than the namesake Vespucci. This initial wave of European colonizers on Turtle Island and the Caribbean islands triggered a series of colonization efforts, with various Spanish figures leading the charge. Among them were Juan Ponce de Leon and Lucas Vazquez de Ayllon, who each left an enduring imprint on the colonial history of Turtle Island. Ponce de Leon, initially part of Columbus's second voyage, later initiated his own colonial pursuits in the southeast of the United States. Meanwhile, Ayllon strove to create a colony in modern-day Georgia, establishing the transient settlement of San Miguel de Guadalupe in 1526. Though Spanish colonization efforts of this era were far from an uninterrupted success story, Pánfilo de Narváez's ill-fated expedition to Florida in 1528 serves as an example, as it resulted in widespread death among his crew. Notwithstanding the disastrous expedition, survivor Alvar Nunez Cabaza de Vaca lived among several indigenous tribes in the areas of present-day Texas and northern Mexico, unwittingly facilitating a cultural cross-pollinization with indigenous inhabitants of Turtle Island and Old World Europeans. A host of other individuals, including the notorious Hernan Cortez the Killer, Francisco Pizarro, Hernando de Soto, and Vasquez Nunez de Balboa, have left their stamp on the historical record due to the profound colonial influence they exerted during the formation of the so-called New World. Reports from these explorers suggest high indigenous populations in the colonized regions. Bartolome de las Casas projected that Hispaniola alone housed between 3 to 4 million inhabitants, while Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo estimated Panama and southern Central America hosted approximately 2 million indigenous people. These figures, however, have recently been subject to strict reevaluation, as indigenous populations are known to have suffered steep declines during the period of these observations following the onset of colonization. By the 1920s, scholarly consensus suggested the 1492 population of Turtle Island was no more than 40 to 50 million, which was later reduced to less than 14 million by the end of the decade. In the 1930s, anthropologist Alfred L. Kroeber proposed a number of 8.4 million for the entire Western Hemisphere, including under 1 million in the area of present-day Canada. Understanding the controversy and implications of such claims, Kroeber called for a new region-specific analysis to be made. A team from the University of British Columbia, featuring Carl Sauer, Sherbin F. Cook, and Woodrow Bora, undertook this task. They examined the extensive data, including church and government archives, leading to an innovative demographic technique known as the Vancouver School. Their analysis estimated 25 million people in central Mexico and 8 million people in Española. By the 1960s, based on numerous Vancouver School studies, Bora suggested a pre-Columbian population exceeding over 100 million. Anthropologist Henry F. Dobbins later concluded that the so-called Americas hosted 90 to 112 million people pre-Spanish arrival, a radical departure from previous estimates. Due to the Vancouver School's rigorous analysis, pre-Columbian population estimates have continued to see significant increases, providing insights into early human and pre-Columbian Turtle Island history, despite many previous uncertainties. Pre-colonial indigenous societies of Turtle Island showcased a vibrant diversity in their social and political structures, suited to their specific locales and historical contexts, spanning from the furthest reaches of the Arctic down to the Peruvian Andes. The northwestern region of Turtle Island, stretching from Alaska down to present-day Washington State, was a melting pot of diverse cultures, which included the Haida, Tlingit, Modocs, Chinook, Macaw, and many others. These societies, renowned for their warrior strength, extended their influences as far as present-day California. A significant aspect of these cultures was the way they visually represented their societal structures and hierarchies through the creation of totem poles. These intricate woodworks of art made from tree logs served as cultural signposts conveying narratives of family lineages, historical events, and spiritual beliefs, further reinforcing their societal dynamics. The social structure of these Northwestern Turtle Island societies incorporated a class of servants, largely comprised of war captives, who made up around a quarter of their population. While this system was compared to a form of chattel slavery by early European observers, it was truthfully more closely resembled to, for lack of a better comparison, the role of draft animals in medieval Europe. These servants were not subjected to undue cruelty or violence, but were in fact assigned to lifetime labor or caregiver roles. Yet, despite the seemingly dominating class-based structure, these societies did operate within a form of egalitarianism subtly interwoven in their social fabric. This egalitarian approach was predominantly showcased in their practice of the potlatch ceremony. These gatherings, characterized by extravagant feasts and competitive gift-giving, were a means to redistribute and at times even intentionally destroy surplus wealth rather than hoarding it. This potlatch tradition underlines these societies' commitment to community benefit over individual accumulation, thereby fostering an undercurrent of equality, even amidst their stern social class hierarchy. Heading further south to the Pacific coastal lands that make up present-day California, the Chumash, Kawiya, and Gabrielino or Tongva tribes exhibited unique cultural facets. Through their comprehensive mutual aid and trade networks and cultural feasts, they displayed remarkable adaptability to their natural and social environments. The concept of a servant class, prevalent in the north, was not entirely foreign to these peoples due to occasional incursions by northern raiding tribes. Such interactions, though, led to significant cultural schismogenesis within indigenous societies of this region. Instead of adopting similar social structures, they resisted forming a servant class, fostering a more balanced societal system. This difference became a defining feature of their social identity. As the Northwestern communities increasingly channeled their cultural ceremonial expression towards the motif of masculine-dominated aggression, the lower Pacific societies responded in kind, pivoting towards more matriarchal knowledge and feminine symbolism, and vice versa. This is far from a rarity, but the relationship between the lower Pacific villagers and their Northwestern counterparts offers a striking case in point when it comes to an example of how these kinds of schismogenetic contrasts between neighboring societies are formed. The social, cultural, and spiritual practices of the lower Pacific villagers would have appeared completely alien and unfamiliar to those inhabiting the Northwest, just as the practices of the Northwest inhabitants would have seemed utterly foreign and strange to the villagers of the lower Pacific. It's important to note, however, that the distinction of these societal structures were not born merely out of whimsical choice or tradition, but rather responses to their respective environmental, ecological, and social circumstances. In the case of the indigenous societies in the Northwest, where terrestrial food was scarce but marine life was bountiful, a system had to be developed to swiftly handle and mass harvest fresh fish nearly instantly. This task demanded a sizable labor force, yet satisfying such labor needs posed a quandary within the existing social fabric. Tribal chiefs found themselves at odds with having to implore their own tribe members into such rigorous labor, as such a move would potentially erode their authority and unsettle their position of power. Acknowledging this delicate balance, they forged a new path by sourcing a servant class from other tribes, thereby ensuring an adequate supply of manpower. On the other hand, the tribes in the lower Pacific region had an access to a wealth of terrestrial resources, and because of this, they didn't depend heavy on marine life as a main food source. As a result, there was no demand for a large labor force, as seen to their north, which allowed them to develop develop a more balanced and equal society. The differences between the two not only reflect adaptive responses to their distinct environmental conditions, but also indicate their comparative adaptation to one another, which offers profound insights into societal evolution under these compounding circumstances. However, it's also important to recognize that this is a generalized comparison and not an absolute rule in any way. Obviously, first of all, I'm in no way an expert. This is an amateur endeavor, and due to time constraints, the goal here is not to detail any all-encompassing truth, but just to outline these broad cultural differences observed between these two regions. Further southwest, communities like the Papago, Pima, and Mojave displayed remarkable cultural diversity. Notable societies like the Anasazi, Hokum, and Mogollon also profoundly influenced the social, cultural, and architectural landscapes of this region. In fact, the southwestern region of Turtle Island showcases one of the most ideal examples of indigenous agricultural acumen in pre-colonial times, with some methods still being employed today. The Hokum, an ancient indigenous civilization tracing its roots back nearly 1700 years, developed comprehensive irrigation networks enabling their existence in the harsh Sonoran Desert. With their homeland stretching across the dry terrain of the Salt and Gila River valleys, where rainfall was a rare occurrence, the Hokum engineered a novel irrigation methodology. This creation is hailed as one of the most advanced irrigation systems on the globe during the peak of its use. Canals that could reach up to 8 feet in depth and 30 feet in width, spanning miles, transformed inhospitable terrains into lush agricultural landscapes. These waterways were not confined to a single use, but were prudently conserved to cultivate riparian, that is, riverbank vegetation. The design of this canal system ingeniously maximized each ounce of water, ensuring not a single drop was wasted. These remarkable achievements signified the cooperative and collective nature of these societies, which strikingly contrasted with both their neighbors in the mid-Pacific and northwestern regions of Turtle Island. Contrary to their northwestern neighbors, who relied on a well-structured workforce frequently resulting in a servant class due to their fishing economy, this society flourished through an alternative collectivist model. For the Hokum peoples, sustaining life was a shared responsibility, not divided by class, but borne by every community member. In this society, the task of managing the intricate infrastructure was collectively handled. All members contributed their labor based on the community's needs. For example, planters were not only confined to agricultural duties, but also served as guardians, protecting their crops from potential threats like pests and wildlife. Key agricultural phases, such as planting and harvesting, witnessed a large group effort and participation from the entire community. This shared responsibility negated the need for a specific servant class or workforce, leading to minimal class difference, unlike their northwestern counterparts. In comparison to their immediate mid-Pacific neighbors, the distinction emerges from the variance in resource availability. While the tribes in the mid-Pacific region enjoyed an abundance of terrestrial resources, negating the need for a clear servant class, the Hokum were driven to establish a unique labor and resource management system. This necessity wasn't done by choice or as a socioeconomic experiment, but rather as a survival imperative born out of their harsh desert environment. Faced with such harsh conditions, they were forced to adopt a collectivist agricultural approach. However, this collaborative agricultural project wasn't just about optimizing resources. It was a requirement imposed by their unforgiving desert environment, which binded individual survival to collective agricultural success. Had the environmental conditions been different, more extreme, or had the population been unable to uphold such efforts, it's likely likely that these people would have been forced to relocate to more hospitable regions. This collectivist practice of advanced agriculture and the evasion of strict social hierarchies only worked because the desert environment necessitated such collective efforts for individual survival. It was not a preferred choice as much as it was a survival strategy demanding the entire community's dedication and commitment for effective functioning. The unprecedented canal system, unrivaled in its magnitude and its time, provided water and consequently food for a significant rural population. In fact, portions of the Holcomb Canal system remain operative today, catering freshwater access to the metropolitan region of so-called Phoenix, Arizona. The intellectual prowess of these ancient indigenous civilizations in the southwest of Turtle Island were not limited to agriculture, but extended to architectural supremacy as well. The Anasazi civilization especially made a profound impact in their architectural ingenuity in the San Juan Basin, located in the area presently known as the Four Corners regions of the United States. Pueblo Bonito, an immense multi-tiered residential complex believed to have been constructed over 1,100 years ago and capable of housing more than 1,200 inhabitants in its heyday, validates their superior construction capabilities. Their architectural accomplishments were unmatched on Turtle Island until the inception of the apartment complex in Manhattan in the 19th century. However, despite a multitude of these structures and settlements spread across the Grand Canyon, only a fraction have been thoroughly researched, as extensive colonial incursions by looters and frontier-era artifact thieves have deprived these sites of any meaningful archaeological exploration. Turning our lens towards the southeastern region of Turtle Island, home to today's American colonial states such as so-called North Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, and more. This region was once a rich land filled with diverse indigenous cultures. North Carolina was home to tribes like the Cape Fear, Shawnee, Catawba, and Chura indigenous peoples. Further south, the Chickasaw and Chacayuma tribes found their homes in Alabama and Mississippi, though their descendants now live in present-day Oklahoma. Florida, a culture epicenter for the Shawnee, Calusa, Chatat, and the Seminole tribes, continues to have a vibrant indigenous presence in this region. The Seminoles, also having communities in Oklahoma and present-day Mexico, exemplify the extensive diaspora of these cultures. Along the coast of South Carolina, the Shakora peoples made their homes, while the Chuwasha tribes lived in present-day occupied regions of so-called Louisiana. The Shakta peoples originally range across Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana, though a significant portion of their population now also resides in Oklahoma. In the sprawling territories from western North Carolina to eastern Tennessee and further, the Cherokee tribes thrived, with their descendants now living mainly in North Carolina and also in Oklahoma. These cultures, each unique in their own right, had certain common social characteristics. The concept of chiefdoms was a pervasive trait where social and political hierarchies were determined by birthright. The chiefs, as a result of their birth status, were given the power of authority over their peoples. These tribes also exhibited a distinct class system with the hereditary nature of inherent social status and privilege. A higher birth class meant more privileges and resources at one's disposal. Kinship and clan systems central to these societies dictated social relationships and responsibilities within their communities. These intricate systems were pivotal to the daily function of these societies. Community cooperation, a significant aspect of these cultures, was manifested through reciprocal sharing of resources and indigenous knowledge. This ethos extended even to the settlers, who often benefited from the indigenous people's knowledge about local food sources and medicinal practices. It's essential, however, to remember that these societies were far from static. Each tribe had its own unique social organization and cultural practices, which continually evolved over time. The onslaught of colonization also enforced assimilation policies by European settlers, which profoundly disrupted these traditional systems, resulting in a permanent shift in the lifestyle of these indigenous cultures. Thank you. ancient civilizations of Turtle Island showcase a magnificent diversity of distinct socio-political structures, architectural designs, and lifestyle adaptations. Indigenous societies in the continent's northwest region were sustained by fishing and foraging, which underpinned their settled lifestyles. These societies were characterized by a rigid social hierarchy and vibrant social traditions that bolster community cohesion, even amidst a class division. On the other hand, indigenous communities in the sun-kissed lands of what is now known as California led a contrasting lifestyle. Their societies were upheld with an egalitarian division of labor and lacked rigid social structures thanks to the region's bountiful resources. This abundance also facilitated the establishment of their sophisticated mutual aid and trade networks, showcasing their deep comprehension of value and exchange. In the Southwest, distinct indigenous communities literally carved their unique cultural legacies into the landscape. Renowned for their advanced agriculture acumen, these communities displayed an intimate relationship with the land. Their prowess extended to architecture, creating structures that continue to enchant modern scholars. Such feats were made possible due to their collectivist labor division and deep-seated expertise in engineering and design. Geographical attributes and the richness of resources available played a pivotal role in the molding of these societies. Fertile lands often led to the emergence of settled communities with elaborate labor systems and societal frameworks. In contrast, areas favoring hunting or foraging nurtured more fluid egalitarian societies with less demand for a division of labor. The intricate link between their habitats and societal structures underscores the significant impact of environmental conditions on the cultural and societal evolutions of indigenous peoples on Turtle Island before colonization began. Regrettably, contemporary historians often misrepresent these pre-Columbian indigenous societies, erroneously labeling them as primitive or crude. Even when acknowledging the more advanced civilizations that we will soon cover, such as the Inca, Aztec, or Mississippian, these societies are often considered anomalies rather than representative of the sophistication inherent to these indigenous cultures. This limited perspective perpetuates the misconception that these indigenous societies devolved into less egalitarian systems as they expanded. Moreover, the undue focus on practices such as the capturing of servants or human sacrifice simplifies and exoticizes the understanding of these intricate cultures, especially when compared to the depravity taking place in the old world during this same era. Fortunately, there's a progressive shift in this narrative. Historical and anthropological studies are evolving, challenging and reassessing traditional political narratives. Perspectives once deemed radical or unorthodox are finding their way into mainstream thought. An increasing number of scholars are dedicated to revisiting and revising outdated interpretations of pre-Columbian indigenous societies on Turtle Island. This effort is helping lead us to a deeper understanding of life on these lands before European colonization began. With this, a more comprehensive and less biased view of these indigenous cultures' complexity and sophistication is emerging, along with many notable contributions made to our understanding of human history as a whole.
Hi, I am utterly delighted to welcome David Vengro and David Graeber. Yes, as our keynote speakers, I don't think either of these speakers need much of an introduction, especially to this audience, but not to many audiences, I don't think so.
The late anthropologist David Graeber and archaeologist David Wingrow co-authored the influential book The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, in 2021. The book showcases the remarkable diversity and intricacy of ancient human societies. Contrary to typical historical narratives proposing a linear progression from primitive to complex societies, the book proposes a different perspective, suggesting that early human societies were vast, intricate, and largely decentralized for millennia.
Thank you for having me. I'm kind of thrown into this suddenly, so I'm trying to assemble my thoughts. There's a lot of things one could say on this topic. People have been telling this story for probably, at least since the time of Hobbes and Rousseau. It was really an Enlightenment story. It goes back to the 18th century, which just resurfaces in one form or another over and over again. And the basic story, we all kind of know it, we absorb it as common sense. You know, once upon a time, there were these little bands of 20 or 40 people, hunter-gatherers, and that's what human life was like for, you know, a million years or so.
And they were happy little egalitarian bands, but they were small and had an egalitarian ethos. But then they discover agriculture and everything kind of starts to go downhill. And that inevitably leads to cities. And once you get cities, necessarily you get civilization. And the civilization just etymologically just means people living in cities, right? But cities necessarily means you also have a surplus and you get people who grab the surplus and become a ruling class. That means you need the state, armies, all of, but also you get writing and culture and so on. So the whole thing comes as a package, love it or leave it. But everybody kind of accepts this as common sense, but the interesting thing is that almost all the evidence we have now indicates that just about every element of this story is factually wrong. Hunter-gatherers are not don't tend to live in tiny bands of 20 or 40 people. They tend to go back and forth seasonally between these little micro-cities, and then they scatter small groups. And often they create elaborate hierarchies, and then they tear them apart again at different times of year. If agriculture messes everything up, it takes about 7,000 years for the effects to actually show up. So that doesn't seem to be the case. Early cities, in contrast, are often really egalitarian. The first 1,000 years of urban civilization in places like Mesopotamia, Indus Valley, there's no signs of social inequality. All the giant buildings, insofar as they have ones, they're not palaces and temples like later, but they're things like giant public bath systems and things that are clearly designed for everybody to use. So all of our narratives are thrown into disarray.
And the really insidious part about it is not the idea of the noble savage. Actually, there is no noble savage in Rousseau's discourse because his state of nature involves creatures which are like humans but actually lack any sort of philosophy at all, because what they can't do is project their own lives into the future and imagine themselves in other states. They're constantly inventing things and chasing their own tails, or rushing headlong for their own chains, as he puts it. They invent agriculture, but they can't see the consequences. They invent cities, but they can't see the consequences. So we're talking about...
No imagination.
Exactly. We're talking about this idea of political self-consciousness sort of receding as one goes further back in time. There was a book published in 1946 by the Dutch archaeologist Henry Frankfurt called Before Philosophy, which was about the ancient Middle East, Mesopotamia and Egypt and all that sort of thing. But he wasn't actually arguing that these people didn't have the capacity for philosophy. He was simply pointing out that they didn't have an explicit written tradition of speculative thought like that of the ancient Greeks. So that when they did speculate, they did it in other ways, through images, through discourse on the non-human world, etc., etc. To find the idea that there have actually ever been individuals who didn't possess any capacity for philosophical reflection, one has to go to Rousseau. But of course, Rousseau is very explicit in saying that this isn't supposed to be history.
Oh, yeah.
I don't actually believe any of this really happened. I mean, he says it very clearly.
It's
in
right
discourse.
There, yeah.
Do not take this as a basis for your reconstruction of what actually happened in the past. This is a thought experiment. And what seems so extraordinary to us is how this thought experiment has somehow mutated into what still appears to be the standard metastructure for human history. So what we find ourselves doing is kind of sort of fighting on two fronts. On the one hand, trying to reinterpret the facts, the evidence of archaeology and history to try and put together some of the pieces of a new sort of story, but also simultaneously having to go right back to the philosophical roots of the existing story so that we're not constantly just sort of pushed back and buffeted back into what seems to be an incredibly powerful myth. And it is a myth. And, you know, one can show it's a myth in fairly concrete ways.
The Dawn of Everything quickly received global recognition as a bestseller and was translated into over 30 languages. It has drawn attention from mainstream media, academic publications, and activist groups, stirring a variety of reactions for its potential to reframe conventional historical studies.
We turn now to a groundbreaking new book. It's titled The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. It's written by the late anthropologist David Graeber and the archaeologist David Wengrow. The book examines how indigenous cultures contributed greatly to what we've come to understand as so-called Western ideas of democracy and equality. But these contributions have been erased from history. After years of research, the two men completed the book in the summer of 2020, just weeks before David Graeber died unexpectedly at the age of 59 on vacation in Venice, Italy. Graeber was a highly influential anthropologist, a veteran of the international anti-capitalist movement that pushed for a different vision of globalization. In both his academic and activist work, David Graeber looked at ways to radically recreate society. We're joined now by his dear friend and co-author, David Wengrow. The two co-wrote The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. David Wengrow is joining us from London, where he's a professor of comparative archaeology at University College London. David, can you talk about, well, just start with the title, The Dawn of Everything, and this new narrative that you both want to bring to the world?
Well, we really started exchanging ideas around the time that you were describing, the time of the Occupy movement. So around 2011, we exchanged books. I gave him a book I'd written on ancient civilizations, and we started swapping ideas. We were interested in how our fields, so I'm an archaeologist, as you mentioned, David was an anthropologist, how we could contribute to debates on social inequality, which had really been escalating since the financial crash of 2008. Initially, we planned to write something quite short, really a sort of pamphlet, just to introduce readers to major discoveries from our fields that we felt hadn't really escaped out of the academy into wider consciousness. Firstly, this very conventional idea that before human beings invented agriculture, we lived almost exclusively in tiny egalitarian bands of hunter-gatherers. It's not true. It's actually wildly inaccurate. There simply was no such period of prolonged political innocence. And secondly, the equally conventional and entrenched idea that our species became trapped in inequality through the invention of agriculture and then later cities. That's not true either. Actually, what the broad sweep of history shows is that living in large-scale, densely populated, technologically sophisticated societies really doesn't require people to simply give up social freedoms in the way that we're often told it does. As you can probably gather by now, this was already getting beyond a short pamphlet.
Graeber and Wengrow questioned the widely held view of human societies as small bands of so-called hunter-gatherers and reject the idea of the rise of agriculture inevitably leading to strict social hierarchies. They also dispute the notion of single dominant social structures, particularly not until thousands of years after agriculture's onset.
From time to time, over the last few decades, historians, some of them, like the historian George Tsui, who is in fact himself of the Huron-Wendat Nation with a PhD in history, have drawn attention to these sources. But for reasons that I can't really explain, that really reflect, I think, very poorly on our institutions and on the academy, they have been marginalized. And one thing we try to do in our book is really shine a light on that existing scholarship.
One of the examples presented in The Dawn of Everything is a popular study by French sociologist and anthropologist Marcel Mauss entitled Seasonal Variations of the Eskimo, which, despite the use of the archaic term, the study stands out as a formidable work in early anthropology, blending a sociological lens with insights from human geography. In it, Mauss makes a compelling case to truly understand a society, one must consider its geographical influence within the intricate web of its social fabric. This symbiotic relationship is shown to continuously adapt to human and environmental changes, with societal structures reflecting their environments even under the most severe conditions. The example given is in the Arctic, where indigenous communities like the Inuit embrace sustainable living and adopting a holistic approach to their use of what were at some time scarce resources. Inuit communities displayed seasonal social adaptations, forming larger, multifamilial groups for collective whale hunting in the winter and dispersing into smaller units with far less hierarchical structures in the summer. These shifting hunting patterns were strategic choices consciously adopted to prevent hierarchical tendencies and to maintain an egalitarian social structure, which was a testament to the Inuit people's profound understanding of societal formation. In fact, the adaptability of indigenous peoples on Turtle Island often exceeded the societal customs handed down through their ethnic lineage, as societal practices often reflected their environmental adaptations much more than their inherited cultural traditions. The relationship between the environment and social structure is even more clear when we look at indigenous groups with similar ethnic backgrounds who have contrasting societal frameworks based on differing locations and natural living conditions. From the 9th to the 16th century, a distinct civilization through the central region of Turtle Island known as the Mississippian culture flourished extensively, primarily centered around the fertile expanses of the Mississippi River and its tributaries. This vibrant society made significant contributions to the cultural and architectural development of the region. The heart of this impressive civilization was Cahokia, now situated in the southern region of modern-day Illinois. Covering a substantial area of 6 square miles, Cahokia was a clear representation of the architectural acumen and social organization of Mississippian culture. Its cityscape was adorned with sophisticated earthwork structures, including pyramid-like platform mounds. These structures were multifunctional and served as temples, royal residences, and elite burial sites, showcasing the complexity of their social hierarchy. Despite its core being in Cahokia, the cultural influence of the Mississippian society wasn't geographically confined to the region, as it extended over 400 miles southwest to Spiro in what is now known as Oklahoma. Spiro played a crucial role within the expansive trading network of the Mississippians, reaching across the central and midwest regions of Turtle Island and even into the southwest. Encompassing 150 acres, the Spiro town site boasted 12 distinct earthen mounds and several elaborate earthworks, underlying its cultural importance within the Mississippian domain. This bustling settlement, active from the 9th century till about the year 1450, served as a prominent center of cultural activity for hundreds of years. Even amid a dwindling population beginning in the mid-13th century, Spiro remained relevant as a ceremonial site, maintaining its spiritual significance throughout the region. While both part of the Mississippian culture, Cahokia and Spiro showcased contrasting social structures. Spiro, primarily inhabited by the Cadoans, had a more fluid, less hierarchical society compared to Cahokia. In contrast, Cahokia, distinguished by its intricate city layout and architectural wonders, epitomized the grandeur of Mississippian culture, marking its significance as a beacon of influence throughout this region of Turtle Island. The majesty of this city, however, also came with the demand for a far more organized division of labor, and in turn led to a much more defined social hierarchy than what was typical in Spiro. The contrasting characters of these two civilizations are visibly reflected in their physical remnants today. In eastern Oklahoma, a massive spiral mound stands as a silent witness to a bygone society that once thrived. Sadly, its cultural treasures have been pilfered, with the site being left vulnerable over time to both natural degradation and colonial looters. In comparison, Cahokia presents a far different picture. There, a sprawling urban expanse with a huge earthen mound remains intact, bearing witness to the complexity and stability of this society. Its survival perhaps indicates a more structured and advanced societal framework in Cahokia, which was comparable in sophistication to the advanced Maya city-states or even the ancient Roman Empire. Many of the indigenous societies who inhabited the common areas of the so-called Americas were not transient people as often portrayed, but were of time well-established and well-organized peoples. They were highly skilled cultivators of the land, creating sustainable agricultural systems which adapted rapidly to their environment. Their cultivation methods were incredibly efficient, maximizing the output of their crops in ways that European settlers did not fully understand or appreciate upon their arrival, nor do we fully understand or appreciate today. In comparison to this, the indomitable aura of the ancient Romans is often presented through grand narratives of intricate political systems, architectural marvels, and sophisticated societal structures. But what is not often discussed is the parallels that could be drawn between the two, these indigenous societies of Turtle Island and that of the Roman Empire of old Europe. Just as the Romans were renowned for their advanced infrastructure and governance systems, indigenous societies on Turtle Island also achieved comparable accomplishments. However, due to ethnocentric bias, these achievements are often overlooked in the historical record. In an era when the Roman Empire exerted its immense influence over ancient Greece, molding the chronicles of Western civilization, a parallel narrative emerged thousands of miles away across the Atlantic on Turtle Island. Indigenous societies like the Adena, Hopewell, Holcomb, Mississippian, and countless others mirrored their European equivalents, manifesting intricate culture steeped in tradition, sophisticated urban designs, and broad-reaching trade networks. The reverberations of these once-thriving societies are still palpable today. Through the tenacious efforts of archaeologists, layers of history have been unveiled, spotlighting civilizations such as the Adena across modern-day regions of Turtle Island, from so-called Ohio to present-day West Virginia. The city planning and architectural mastery of these indigenous societies on Turtle Island stood toe-to-toe with that of ancient Rome and ancient Greece. Settlements from humble homes to vast urban communal spaces were precisely organized in concentric order surrounding significant religious monuments, sometimes known as sacred circles. A profound veneration for the dead was a defining characteristic of the Adena culture. Grand tombs, sometimes challenging the magnificence of the Egyptian pyramids or Roman mausoleums, profoundly commemorated their cultural and hereditary lineage. Skillfully harnessing their natural resources, these indigenous societies became experts in many forms of hunting and fishing, as well as the cultivation of various crops, which showcased an agricultural expertise far more advanced than many European cultures of the same time period. Expansive trade routes reaching to distant locales like from the so-called Carolinas all the way up to Lake Superior sourced treasures such as mica and copper, drawing parallels with ancient Mediterranean trade. In tandem with the Adena, the Hopewell culture, another bedrock society of Turtle Island, marked its presence from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico and from Kansas to so-called Western New York. Their distinct earthen landmarks served not only as architectural wonders, but also as vessels of profound spiritual and celestial insights. These structures echoed the majestic amphitheaters and temples of many observed in the ancient Old World. Just as the Greeks and Romans extensively traded across the Mediterranean, the Hopewell utilized Turtle Island's rivers for their commerce, dealing in furs, tools, and fashioning lavish artifacts from copper, silver, and gold. The aforementioned Mississippian culture was another radiant beacon illuminating Turtle Island's vast central expanse. Their monumental undertakings, spiritual endeavors, and extensive trade and mutual aid networks further cemented the notion that advanced civilization's heart rhythm was not confined solely to that of the Old World. These indigenous cultures symbolize the rich, diverse continuum of human advancement on Turtle Island, and like the much more talked about European empires that ascended and left their eternal legacy on world history, these indigenous cultures engraved their distinct signatures on the land of pre-colonial Turtle Island. When comparing these impressive indigenous civilizations with ancient European realms, we are faced with this overarching realization. Across diverse lands, time periods, and eras of various empires, human beings fueled by similar goals, apprehensions, and visions have consistently sculpted history, crafted beauty, and pursued cosmic and spiritual comprehension, intertwining our existence into a deep understanding and conscious expression of our collective human nature and species being. Thank you for listening to part one of this episode of Cue the Coup, a creation of Spark of Life Media. Cue the Coup is written by me, Al Content, with many borrowings in this episode from both American Holocaust by David Stainer and The Dawn of Everything by David Graeber and David Wengrow. Cue the Coup is a production of Spark of Life Media, presented for your listening at decolonize.ca. Our theme music is by Lee Reed, with additional music provided by Wapakoni Mobile, Robin Edgar, The Rebel Spell, Neon Natives, Hallucination, Karkwa, Nadav Cohen, Cousin Tyler, Brian Eno, James Horner, Arc Angie, Quentin Leo Cook, and Dr. Ida Helpern. All music and audio sources for this episode are being used under the Fair Use Act and under the Creative Commons International Public Use License. For all sourced information from this episode, please visit decolonize.ca or follow us on Twitter and our social media at Cue the Coup. Tune into part two of this episode, where we'll journey further into the pre-Columbian era, spanning from the Arctic and the vast Great Plains all the way down to the southernmost tip of the opposite hemisphere. We'll explore further what life was like on Turtle Island before the age of so-called discovery, in pursuit of understanding the profound transformation that shaped the world we inhabit here today. Thank you for listening.